going to go ahead and get started. Thank you so much for being here. Like I said, I hope you had a great Christmas and are a good start to the new year thus far. You are very brave for coming out on a Monday night right after the holidays. First day back at school for most, first day back at work for so many. So we appreciate your time. I think you're in for a treat tonight, and we look forward to what's ahead. Just for those of you, since there are many of you in the room that aren't familiar with the school, I just wanted to introduce myself briefly. My name is Jean Kim, and I'm the founder and the headmaster here of the Cambridge School, and it's our joy and our privilege to be hosting this event tonight. The Cambridge School, just to tell you a little bit about it for those of you who don't know about us, is a classical Christian school that was founded just 8.5 years ago, and we had just 9 students in kindergarten through first grade. And by God's grace, we've grown from those humble beginnings to now serve more than 210 students in kindergarten prep through 9th grade, in spite of the fact that we had a great recession recently and other economic challenges. And just this past year, we successfully launched our high school with our first freshman class. So we're really excited to be adding grades, one grade a year until we're a full K-12 school. And in the sea of either-or educational options, either academically rigorous or spiritually robust, we occupy a unique niche in the educational landscape of San Diego. We offer a distinctive education that marries both a rich Christian anthropology, from which we glean our telos, or the end and purpose of our education, along with the tried and true pedagogy and means of a historic liberal arts education, which includes great books, Socratic discussion, Latin, logic, rhetoric, all that good stuff. So in contrast to the either-or options that are out there, we see ourselves as really a both-and kind of school, one that provides an education that is both academically rigorous and spiritually robust, one that seeks excellence but also seeks humility, and both seeks to inform and shape the appetite as well as the intellect, hearts as well as minds. So together, this Christian anthropology and classical pedagogy provide a rich educational experience that is not merely informative, but also very transformative, hopefully by God's grace. So hopefully, having formed rightly ordered affections and excellent habits of mind in our students through our very intentional and integrated curriculum, pedagogy, and culture, we are looking forward to sending forth generations of young people who have cultivated wisdom and virtue in an age of trivial pursuits, and who are well prepared for a lifetime of learning, service, and leadership for the glory of God, the good of neighbor, and the delight of their own souls. And this kind of classical Christian education that we provide here at Cambridge resonates very much with the work that's being done at Gordon College, and the lives of slightly older students. And so tonight it's my privilege to introduce Dr. Michael Lindsay, who is an award-winning sociologist, educator, and the 8th president, and I believe the youngest president, college president, of Gordon College, just outside of Boston, Massachusetts, which he is working hard to position as the liberal arts college of choice worldwide for the development of thoughtful Christian leaders. And originally from Jackson, Mississippi, President Lindsay holds graduate degrees in theology from Princeton Theological Seminary and Wycliffe Hall at Oxford, and he earned his PhD in sociology from Princeton University. And both he and his wife, Rebecca, who's also here with us today, graduated Phi Beta Kappa from Baylor University, and I believe we have some Baylor alums in our midst, too. He taught at Rice University, where he directed the program for study of leadership, and served as the Rice Scholar at the James A. Baker Institute for Public Policy, in addition to winning a Distinguished Teaching Award, which is wonderful to hear at a research university that you're teaching well. So President Lindsay is a strong advocate for Christian leadership, as defined by a commitment to excellence and service, both hallmarks of the Gordon experience. He's introduced 2 new programs at Gordon designed to inspire and mentor the next generation of thoughtful Christian leaders: the Gordon Presidential Fellows Program, which is modeled after the highly selective White House Fellows Program, and the Elevate Program at Gordon College, which is a week-long experience for high school students, preparing them for leadership around the world. And so Dr. Lindsay's most recent book, View from the Top, was released last year, and we have some copies for sale today, and he'll be signing some of them later on, and we also have a raffle, so hopefully you got a raffle ticket for a few of those. It was released last year and reports the findings of his 10-year platinum study, the largest ever interview-based study of senior organizational leaders, including former Presidents Carter and Bush, hundreds of CEOs, and the nation's largest corporations and nonprofits. So Dr. Lindsay's Pulitzer Prize-nominated Faith in the Halls of Power was listed in Publishers Weekly Best Books of 2007. And his work has been profiled in hundreds of media outlets worldwide, including the New York Times, the Wall Street Journal, USA Today, CNN, and Fox News. So we're privileged to have this opportunity today to hear Dr. Lindsay speak while he's in town for other business, escaping the Boston cold and enjoying our beautiful weather here in San Diego. He will speak, and then afterwards we'll have a little time for Q&A, and then after that we will raffle off a few of the books, and he'll be available for book signing over there. Without further ado, please join me in giving Dr. Lindsay a warm welcome.
So it's really wonderful to be here with you. Gene, thank you very much for that kind introduction. I hope that you hold on to those comments at the very beginning. It's a beautiful articulation of what you're trying to do here at the Cambridge School. And it is obvious to me you're doing some really amazing work. So blessings. And may the Lord continue to cause it to flourish. And may all of your students come to Gordon College. That's what I'm hoping for. I'm here tonight because Gene had a chance to hear me give a version of this presentation in August to a gathering, a national gathering of leaders in classical Christian education. And, you know, it's wonderful to be able to work on a research project that ends up having some practical application. And I'm living proof that you can write a dissertation that your wife will describe as actually interesting. And so this research project began as my dissertation at Princeton, continued on while I was a faculty member at Rice, and then culminated with the release of this book called View from the Top. As Gene mentioned, it's based upon 550 face-to-face interviews. It literally did take me about 8 years to conduct those interviews. I traveled everywhere from Bar Harbor, Maine to Pearl Harbor, Hawaii, and logged about 400,000 frequent flyer miles, which we still enjoy to this day. Got a chance to meet some amazing people, former Presidents Carter and Bush, about 80 cabinet secretaries, heads of federal bureaus and agencies, senior White House officials, as well as 250 CEOs of some of the largest organizations in our culture, Fortune 100 companies like the CEO of AT&T, of GE, of Walmart, as well as heads of major nonprofit organizations and the presidents of major research institutions like the presidents of Harvard and Stanford and Princeton and Duke. It was a wonderful project. A lot of people ask me, how did you get a chance to interview those amazing people? A lot of times it's a matter of being in the right place at the right time. I was actually out in Silicon Valley conducting some interviews with some technology executives. I had a couple of hours to kill, so I went over to the bookstore at Stanford. And I'd been in the bookstore for just a couple of minutes when I look out the corner of my eye and I see a woman who looks exactly like Karen Hughes. Now, you may recall Karen Hughes was appointed counselor to the president for President George W. Bush in 2001. She had been his communications advisor. I knew that she was active in her Presbyterian church in Austin. And I had been trying to get an interview with Karen Hughes literally for years. And here she was in the flesh. Or so I thought. And this is my big chance to actually ask her for an interview. I had to sort of get my nerve up to actually, I never actually asked somebody for an interview face to face. I had asked them via letter and email and telephone. You know, what if you ask somebody for an interview and they don't give it to you? It's like asking somebody out on a date face to face. If they say no, it's really humiliating. So I needed to get my nerve up. So I decided I'd just sort of circle around Karen Hughes at the bookstore and get my nerve up. And after I'd done a circle, I realized I'm not quite ready for this. So I circled around a second time, made a little bit larger circle, still wasn't quite ready. So I did a third circle. I actually circled around Karen Hughes five times at the Stanford bookstore. At the end of the fifth cycle, I decided, you know what, this is too stressful. And I walked out of the store. Now, if you know the Stanford bookstore, there's this large plaza area outside there. And I'm standing out there and thinking, now, God, what was that about? Why was her opinion of me so very important? So what if she says no? She'll forget it in 5 minutes. I'll remember it the rest of my life. So I walked back into the bookstore, and I can't find her. And I thought, oh, this is divine punishment. So eventually I noticed she's upstairs in the coffee bar. So I start walking up the stairs, and as I'm going up there, I'm thinking, how do I address her? Do I call her Madam Counselor or Counselor Hughes, Mrs. Hughes? Hey, Karen, you know, what am I supposed to say? So I didn't know. I'm still having this conversation when I reach her, so I just tapped her on the shoulder. She turned around. Now, when I get nervous, I have this habit of red splotches appearing on my neck. And when she turned around, I could feel the blood rushing up my face. I knew I had about 60 seconds before I would be beat red. I said, Mrs. Hughes, my name is Michael Lindsay. I'm working on this research project that's trying to interview people in positions of influence who are also serious about their faith. Would you be willing to sit down with me? She said, well, I'm actually out here looking at colleges with my son, but let me give you my number, and if you call me in a couple months, I'd be happy to sit down with you. Sure enough, I gave her a call a few months later. I said, Mrs. Hughes, this is Michael Lindsay. I don't know if you remember me. She said, oh, yes, a young man who turned bright red at Stanford. I said, yes, ma'am, that's me. We ended up doing the interview at the Hay Adams Hotel, which is right across the street from the White House in Washington. And it was an amazing interview, because here's a woman who had not spent her whole life trying to claw her way into the inner circle of political power. She sort of found herself there by accident. And in many ways, it was a sense of providence and calling that brought her to that place. But once she got there, she was working incredibly long hours, really stressful job. She had a husband and a teenage son. She wasn't spending much time with either of them. And she began to wonder, is this really what my life is about? Thinking and grappling with questions of identity and vocation, they're ones that we face not just when we're in high school or college, we're making big decisions. We actually face them on a daily basis. Today, what I want to do with you is just share with you some of the insights that I learned over the course of the last 10 years while working on View from the Top that I think may have applicability to the important work that you're doing here at the Cambridge School or in wherever the Lord has opened up the door of influence for you. And then hopefully we can have a chance for some conversation. I've become convinced that we live in such a day and age that we really suffer from a problem that is in part a little bit of our own making. And that is that the wider culture has lost an interest in the relevance of the gospel and its importance to shaping a moral imagination and a vision for the common good, because truthfully, there is so much intellectual and moral rot within the church. And so much of what we have done is set a very bad example. And in no way am I an exemplar, or really are any of us. We're simply pilgrims that are trying to find our way. But I do hope that there might be some stories that I learned along the way that were inspirational and encouraging for me that might help us think about what could we do that might honor the Lord in this place and through this particular moment. One of the things that I became convinced of, which resonates very much with the model of classical Christian education, which is that we really need to embrace what I call a liberal arts approach to life and to leadership. That in essence, what we really need to do is be helping to draw together the wide spectrum of opportunities for young people. Because if you aspire to leadership in one area or another, you really have to cultivate that liberal arts approach to life. Interesting. What I found is that I interviewed 550 people, and we collected massive amounts of data on these individuals. It's the largest study of its kind. The last time a big study was done like this was in 1970 by a team of researchers at Columbia. They interviewed 545 people, so my goal was 546. We just barely beat it at 550, but what we collected, literally hundreds of quantitative variables. And we transcribed the interview. It was about an hour-long interview. I sat down with them. We looked for a variety of different patterns and codes. And we asked a lot of very specific questions about their backgrounds. 75% of them actually earned a liberal arts degree in college. They tended to be people who were intellectual polyglots, who were well-read in many different subjects. In fact, when I do a briefing for CEOs, they always are asking me, how do I identify the next leader for my company or for my organization? And I say, take a group of candidates to a dinner party and figure out who is the best conversationalist, because that is someone who has relational entrepreneurship skills. They're able to build ties with lots of different folks. It's interesting because there is one subject that is the great bridge builder in our culture that allows people, whether you're trying to interact with the dock workers or nuclear physicists, that allows to build connections. Anybody guess what that subject would be? What topic of conversation would be the great bridge builder in our culture today? Kids. Kids is a good guess, but it's not kids. Sports. That's it, sports. Sports becomes the great bridge builder. But guess what? You don't actually major in sports in college. Well, some people do, but you should not. What you're really trying to do is cultivate a broad understanding across the whole spectrum of the human endeavor. You want to be able to know something about archaeology and art. You want to know something about music and literature. You want to know something about politics and international affairs. Practical advice. I tell every high school senior they ought to subscribe that year to The Economist. Why? Because it'll expose them to a wide range of issues written from a different perspective. It's published in the UK, helps them to sort of see that the US is not the center of the universe, and also helps them to get an understanding of some of the wider issues and the ways in which things are being discussed. And actually, The Economist takes religion quite seriously. So if you look at it, it's a good source. Practical things. I also tell folks it's important for you to find news sources that are different than your own political ideology. So if you're, you know, political conservative, you need to listen to MSNBC. And if you're political liberal, you need to watch Fox News. Why? Because you need to have some of that kind of broader understanding, that great bridge building, and you can just grit your teeth in between. Liberal arts approach to life and to leadership is very important, and it's something that we cultivate in our young people at very early ages. Rebecca and I have a 10-year-old daughter, Elizabeth, and twin girls, Caroline and Emily, who are 4 and a half going on 14. And we're thinking a lot, actually, about the great value of classical Christian education. It certainly is the model that we try to embrace at Gordon. And because we believe in it so much for higher education, it seems to me that it makes sense for us to be thinking about it at much earlier ages. We want our girls to be exposed to the broad spectrum of ideas, and we want them to have that broad base of understanding. One of the great challenges that we have in our culture today is that we need to instill within our young people a flexible, deep, and meaningful moral imagination. In essence, what we need to do is we need to create an environment where our young people can actually conceive of the good, the right, and the fitting in an unpredictable world. The Army has an acronym to describe how they think we ought to respond to the challenges of our contemporary culture. They say that we live in a VUCA world, V-U-C-A. It's a world that's characterized by volatility, by uncertainty, by complexity, and by ambiguity. The very best antidote to helping to respond to that environment is to have a liberal arts approach to life that can allow you to conceive of a moral imagination that can allow you to anticipate the problems. Here's the issue with ethics formation for young people today. The primary ethical conundrums that your sons and daughters are going to face, that my girls are going to face, have not been conceived of at this moment. We had no idea the ethical challenges that technology and the issues that we would face around medical ethics, we could not conceive of them 20 years ago, which means that we can't imagine what our kids are going to be facing 20 years from now. So they need to have a moral imagination that covers the broad spectrum. So one of the things that I think is really important is holding up examples for young people that allow them to be able to see how have people been able to stand for the courage of their convictions. Now, one person who really impressed me significantly is a guy named Gerard Arpey. Gerard had spent most of his career working in the airline business. He was the number two person at American Airlines on 9/11. Because his boss was out of pocket, it was Gerard who had to make the very difficult decision to ground the entire airline within a matter of about 2 minutes of getting information that one of their planes had been hijacked and another was no longer responding. He had 2 minutes to make a decision. He ended up making the right decision, grounding the entire airline. But in many ways, Gerard had been deeply shaped by his Christian upbringing that would prepare him for a lot of challenges. I sat down with Gerard in 2010. At the time, American was the only flagship carrier in the United States who had not declared bankruptcy. As you know, bankruptcy has been a model which has allowed a lot of the airline industry to restructure their long-term debts and obligations, principally allowing them to renegotiate their labor contracts that they have. Delta, United, Continental, all these different firms have done it, but American had not. Gerard had become convinced, out of his own sort of Christian convictions, that for American to declare bankruptcy would be a moral failure of his leadership. Now, I have a wonderful friend named David Skeel, who teaches law at the University of Pennsylvania. He's one of the country's leading experts on bankruptcy law. He's a committed believer. And David actually thinks that the bankruptcy law in the United States is actually one of the most moral things that we do. It creates an opportunity for resetting. I'm not here to make an argument about the moral legitimacy of bankruptcy. But for Gerard Arpey, a leader of a single institution at one moment, he became convinced that for Americans to declare bankruptcy would be a moral failure because they did not need the cash. It was largely about restructuring their labor union contracts. I continued to stay in touch with Gerard after we did the interview, realizing that the American board was increasingly putting pressure on him because they wanted to do it. They were losing ground to the competitors. And so one morning, I woke up and turned on the Today Show and heard that American Airlines had announced that they would be declaring bankruptcy. And I immediately thought of that interview with Gerard and wondered, what in the world was he doing? And how was he responding to that issue? And then the newscaster said, and in related news, Gerard Arpey, the CEO, has stepped down from the position. Gerard made the decision that he could not be the person to lead America through the bankruptcy because it would be a moral failure. By stepping down, he cut what we would refer to as the golden parachute. He cut basically all the financial incentives that had been built in his contract for about 25 years to stay at American. It was a decision that cost him personally tens of millions of dollars. Now, Gerard is not out searching for food tonight. He's doing just fine. But one of the things that really stood out to me is that this is an example of a business leader who came to a particular moral conviction and was willing to sacrifice a lot of personal gain to hold fast to that particular moral conviction. That is a story our young people need to hear. We live in a culture where there are not nearly enough courageous leaders of moral conviction. One of the great challenges that I think we face in the church is that so much of what we think about moral formation is basically creating a reductive moral code, a list of do's and don'ts. The reason why that does not work much after you get out of elementary school is because we can't conceive of all of the issues that would need to have the do's and don'ts, right? I deal with college students. It is impossible for us to come up with a master list of all the do's and don'ts we want them to consider to make sure they stay on the straight and narrow path. They are far too creative to come up with all kinds of alternative scenarios. What we need to cast for them is a compelling moral vision that doesn't list for them sort of an ethical straitjacket in which they must exist, but actually draws them out to try and pursue the good, the true, the beautiful. The things that would actually be Christ-honoring in a VUCA world and would help them to develop that moral imagination that could sustain them to make the right decisions. I will say it's been interesting. Most of my formation in higher education actually has occurred outside of a Christ-centered institutional context. I did graduate work at Princeton, taught at Rice, and then made the move to Gordon about 3.5 years ago. And it has been so freeing, I will just say, to be at Gordon, because I can live into who I really am, and I don't have the same sort of concerns about what people would think of me as I try to articulate my faith conviction. One of the things that I would oftentimes get invited to do, so the senior administration at Rice knew I was a Christian, and so they brought me out to talk to the parents often, because the Christian's going to say the nice thing, and the parents are going to like it. And so I would speak to prospective parents, I would speak at gatherings, at orientation, different things like that. And one of the things that I would say at orientation is, it is too late if you want to impart some great pearl of wisdom when you're saying goodbye tomorrow to your son or daughter that will keep them on the straight and narrow path. That moment has come and gone. However, it is probably good for you to remind them on a weekly basis throughout the rest of their freshman year that they make decisions on a daily basis that will affect their destiny. You see, moms and dads, many of you are going to leave your son and daughter tomorrow. And 9 months from now, they're going to be very different people. And for some of them, they are not going to be the young people you want them to be. And it's because they're going to make a series of decisions. Not one big decision, but they're going to make a decision on Friday night that will lead to a decision the following week. That will lead to a decision the following week. You see, the reason why they're going to wind up in a very different place is because they're going to take a series of small steps over the course of this year that actually is going to put them in a very different trajectory. so that when they graduate from this place, they could be a very different person than you brought them to this institution to be. That is the reality of most of higher education. Now, at Gordon College, it's all different. But I will say, I think it is really important for us to think about the moral formation of our sons and daughters, and for us to be less focused on building a reductive moral code of do's and don'ts, and instead be much more focused on how do we draw something that compels them to pursue what is good, right, and fitting. Not force them into some kind of ethical choices, but to draw them out. I mean, a very small thing that actually is not a small thing, but it's one that's very tangible, is how do we think about pornography? And how do we keep them to avoid the temptations of pornography, which are all around us? And it is impossible for you to shield your sons or daughters from pornography for the rest of their lives. You will not be able to do it. So how is it that we create an environment where they are not drawn to that, where they say, that's not a lifestyle that I choose? A compelling moral vision is what we need to develop. There is a degree in which individual ethics and behavior matter a great deal. We need a generation of young people who take responsibility for their actions. We do. Our actions really matter, which is why it's important that we teach consequences. It is really very important that your sons and daughters fail miserably before they go to college. And if you are not creating an environment where that failure will occur in some way before they graduate high school, then frankly, you're not doing a good job parenting. Because they need to experience that failure, learn from it, and be prepared, because failure is coming in a big way. And if they don't experience failure in the context of a loving, nurturing community early on, then it's much harder for them to grapple with what this failure means to their identity and to their future. It's interesting because I've been the president of Gordon College now. This is my fourth year. And every year, we have seen a 10% increase in the number of students who are seeking out our counseling center services. Every year. That means that today, it's 40% more than it was when I started this job. That is an amazing growth. And I was just talking earlier today with our Vice President for Student Life, Jennifer Jakonovich, and we were just saying, what is going on with this generation of college students? And why is it, you know, the stigma of getting counseling has somehow diminished? Maybe there's some of that. But there is a whole generation of young people that are very anxious about failure. Very anxious. So we want to encourage them to experience that while they're still at home, while they still have a community. So let's not try and create this cocoon of comfort and of constant affirmation where they don't actually experience something, where they fail miserably. In the process that they learn a lot that can actually help them be prepared for what comes next. Incidentally, of the 550 people I interviewed, every single one of them could point to a very significant professional failure that preceded a significant growth in their life. Every single one of them could talk about something amazing. I mean, I literally could rattle through all of the different sort of scenarios of individual. I mean, Jamie Dimon being fired at Citibank before he goes over to JPMorgan Chase, I got a long list of them. Lots of people who have failed that end up, that becomes a very significant part of their growth and development. But I think that we make a mistake, especially within the evangelical community, when we really focus on the individual behavior and forget that we need to be able to think about a much larger sort of enterprise of moral formation and a moral imagination, which is creating an environment that also recognizes we have a divine calling for responsible citizenship. We are here for something that's much bigger than just keeping our noses clean. We're here for something much bigger than just sort of making sure our little world is okay. We're actually responsible for a much larger mandate, a cultural mandate, to actually try and really be a blessing to the nations. This is Barry Rowan. Barry serves as the number two person at Vonage, telecommunications company. And Barry got drawn to business in large part because he said, I was drawn to the idea of scale and scope. He thought that he might be in one particular profession while he was in college, but he got drawn to the business world because he said, I realized I could have a multiplicative effect. I'd be able to reach a much larger network of individuals. Whether that's music or social work, education, business, technology, or law. We need a whole generation of committed Christ followers who have a real sense of calling to the much wider task of what we are called to do. I think that really matters. That part of the moral imagination is that we want to improve the world. Now, it's interesting. I have a really good friend named Andy Crouch, who's written a book called Playing God. And in the book, he has this anecdote where he says, if you track the number of titles that have been published with the phrase "change the world" in the title, it has grown exponentially within the last 25 years. In fact, he says, if you look at all the titles that are in the main university library at Harvard, which is probably as good as the Library of Congress for titles that are out there, and that were in the publication, from the beginning of the printing press until 1900, the number of titles that had changed the world in them, I think, was like 19. But then, in essence, what he sees is that there's this geometric effect that goes on from 1900 to today, where we're all about interested in changing the world. That's become sort of a great mandate, and a lot of Christians are invested in that as well. I do want us to change the world, but I think it's probably better for us to think more about how we use our moral imagination to try and make the wider culture a place that would lead to the flourishing of society, to lead to the flourishing of God's kingdom. Moral imagination, not just as individual ethics, but also as responsible citizenship. There are lots of ways that this can occur. One is that we need to remember that we have been blessed in order to be a blessing. There has never in the history of the world been such a group of committed Christ followers who have been given more resources than the current generation of Christians in the United States today. Never. We have never been wealthier. We have never had more connections. We have never had more education. We've never been healthier. We've never had as many opportunities. One of the key things that we need to do is we need to maximize those opportunities. This is a guy named Kevin Plank. Kevin was a football player for the University of Maryland. And by his own telling, he was a mediocre college football player. He could play, but he was not going to be drafted for the NFL. Some of his friends were drafted for the NFL, but Kevin was interested in trying to really make a positive difference. He's a Catholic and wanted to be able to try and help improve the world. One of the things that he noticed was that he came in from one of the two-a-day practices, took off his shoulder pads, and realized he had this T-shirt underneath. He took it off, and he put it on a scale. It weighed 6 pounds because it was weighted with sweat. And he thought, you know, if there was a fiber that could somehow wick away this moisture, it'd be amazing how much more that would improve my performance. He got thinking about that and wanted to be able to make some investments, ended up taking about $600, invested in 6 different fibers, and in the end, he found a particular fiber that was very effective. That was the beginning of an entire industry we know as performance apparel, and with that, he founded the company called Under Armour. Kevin was not the smartest student in his class. He was not the fastest athlete. He was not going to be the guy drafted by the NFL, but he always had been somebody who was able to maximize opportunities. Thank you. I have some water. I should take advantage of it. Thank you. One of my big messages to the students at Gordon is that we have been blessed to be a blessing to the wider world. And it is high time that we take advantage of the gifts and opportunities we have been given. Second is that I think it's really important when we're thinking about leadership that works for the common good is that there is an iceberg effect to leadership. We may see a little bit of what a leader does that's above the surface, but the vast majority of the work of leading enterprises or organizations occurs below the surface. I became convinced after doing this project that a leader's best work rarely sees the light of day. Most of the best things that happen for leadership does not get public attention. You and I don't know about it. I would venture that Gene's best work, none of you are aware of. Why? Because leaders of all kinds of organizations, whether it be a classical Christian school or a university or a Fortune 500 company, leaders are trying to do 2 things. They're trying to keep bad things from becoming worse, or they're trying to make good things happen that in the end don't materialize. Trying to keep bad things from becoming worse? Well, you don't go around and tell people, I just spent the last 3 days solving this personnel problem, that if it had made it into the paper, we would have really had a problem. Nope. You just keep that quiet. But you spent 3 days working on that issue. And You also don't go around and say, you know, we almost did this amazing partnership with this school in Beijing. Well, in the end, it fell apart, but it was going to be great if it had worked out. No, you just move on. Most of what leaders do is they keep bad things from becoming worse, or they're working to bring about good things that in the end don't materialize. And so it is very easy for us to become cynical about leaders. And we see this among our young people. And it's because, frankly, they don't realize what leaders are actually doing. I became convinced while doing this research that no matter who is in the White House, I will not personally criticize those folks in leadership because, frankly, I am not smart enough nor tough enough for those jobs. The National Security Advisor typically works 16 to 18-hour days, 6 days a week. The White House Chief of Staff typically is in the White House before 5:30 in the morning, and they typically leave the White House between 8 and 11 p.m. at night. And that is their pace 7 days a week. It is a very demanding job. I asked some of the people I interviewed in the White House, why is it so intense and why do people only stay in Washington for 2 years? They said, you know that feeling when you go into the office, it's 8 o'clock in the morning and you've got all these things that are happening and a lot of things have been building up overnight. Your inbox is full, lots of things to do. And you, in your mind, you've got something you're really wanting to work on. And you sort of begin your day. And once you get into the groove, then you sort of get a pattern and it starts to work its way out. And eventually you find yourself, okay, I can sort of go home at 5, 6, 7 o'clock and feel like I've really accomplished a good day. They said, the White House is a 24-hour operation because it serves the world, not just the United States. And it is 8 o'clock in the morning every hour of the day somewhere in the world. And those people are calling us. So when it's 8 o'clock in Sri Lanka, it might be 9 p.m. at the White House. But we've got to respond. The iceberg effect of leadership. A leader's best work oftentimes doesn't see the light of day, which is why we have to cultivate in our young people an appreciation for doing good work, even if it does not get recognized or praised. Which is why that lesson about leadership matters so much. We have created a culture where we really want to affirm and encourage our young people, which is so important. But that can become a narcotic in our psyche, where all we want is that approval and support. And we miss the fact that a lot of the work that we have to do is a calling. And it may or may not actually get us accolades. It's part of the work we have been given. Third approach that I learned over the course of this research is that the crucible of crisis rarely, if ever, develops character. It simply reveals it. Why? Because when you are in crisis management mode, you do not have time to pay attention to your soul. You're riding on fumes in that moment. You have to think about how do you respond to the crucible of crisis long before you get there. And you have to simply respond in the moment. Intuition becomes much more significant. This is Andy Card, who served as White House Chief of Staff to President Bush. The moment he's whispering into the president's ear on 9/11 that America's under attack, a second plane has hit the World Trade Center. We actually had Andy speak on campus about 2 years ago, I guess it was. Interesting story because he talked about the intensity of that particular week of his life and how he really had relied upon many, many years, decades, of a daily practice that he and his wife's a Methodist minister, they would get up in the morning and read scripture and pray together. And he said, that was part of our routine. It became part of my life while I was in the White House, and it's just what we did. He said, I really relied upon that to manage the intensity of the crucible of crisis. In a very small way, I have experienced a little portion of that. If you Google my name in the Boston Globe, you'll see all kinds of interesting things. Gordon College came under scrutiny within the last 6 months because we, like about 100 other institutions, have a community covenant that says if you're a student or an employee at our college, you're going to be part of this community, and there's a set of sort of Christian ethics and values that we really think are important. One of those is a prohibition against homosexual practice. So we have had gay students at Gordon. We've had gay employees at Gordon. We just simply ask that they remain celibate and not active in a relationship while they're part of the Gordon community. We've had this in place for literally 50 years. It's been part of our community covenant. However, it came to the attention of the Boston Globe over July 4th weekend. 40% of the Globe's editorial staff is gay. Boston is a very pro-LGBT community. And there was a concerted effort by the LGBT advocacy organizations to target Gordon once this became public, because the idea was that Gordon is one of four nationally ranked Christian colleges. If they could apply enough pressure on me or on the college to change its position, it could have a ripple effect for Christian institutions across the country. And I will say that I've always been a hard worker, always been somebody who gets up, and I love the work that I do. I've been very engaged in it. I have never worked as hard in my life as I did in the months of July, August, and September of 2014. Incredibly intensive season. Part of it was, I was praying. I didn't know what to do. It was the 100-year storm that came to our institution. I was The Boston Globe did not have a picture of our campus, so they took my headshot for every article that they used. So I became the face of intolerance to all of New England. They wrote two news stories that had inaccuracies in them, and after we kept pushing them on this, they decided, well, we'll just move it to the editorial page. So then they wrote two entire editorials against Gordon College around our policy, and then they had two of their columnists sort of write hit pieces on me and the college. We had local school districts take action against our student teachers. We had a community where we had done partnership work for 10 years, where we literally had invested $3 million. Their school committee decided they wanted to cut ties and not accept our students as volunteers on a weekly basis. We did 14,000 hours of volunteer service in that community last year alone. And within basically one news story, they decided we weren't going to work with Gordon anymore. It was a very difficult season. In that environment, I have to say, there was no intentional processing of how am I going to cultivate my character through this moment. I was just responding to what was coming on a daily basis. The crucible of crisis, it really doesn't provide a chance to develop character as much as it sort of reveals it. I do think that there becomes a process, though, in which the Lord allows us to reflect on those series and experiences, and I do hope that that shapes our character going forward. But it's typically we're riding on intuition and responding in the moment. I also became convinced that there's very much a priestly dimension to leading in our culture. Probably one of the key ideas is that leaders today do not so much talk about, espouse, or create values for their institutions. They embody them. So Steve Jobs becomes a great sort of exemplar of this. So much of what you and I know of Apple, the brand, is sort of transmitted through the persona of Steve Jobs, which is why it matters a great deal the character and the personality of our sons and daughters and who they become, because they're going to represent something much larger than themselves. It matters a great deal. One of the things that I became interested in is, how do these people who work these crazy hours, how do they actually have normal family life? How is it that they sort of create some kind of balance? And I have to say, they're generally not very balanced people. And so it's not necessarily something that you're going to hold up as a paragon of, oh, they've got it all worked out. No, they're just sort of trying to make it work on a weekly basis. But one of the key things that I did learn is that they incorporate rituals into their family life, because young people, our sons and daughters, they crave routines. And so they figure out ways to make pancakes on Saturday morning, or to have the same spot to vacation on July 4th weekend. And that becomes a way in which these families create some kind of sense of normal cohesion in the midst of very demanding jobs. Incidentally, I did conclude it is possible to have an incredibly demanding job and to have a fulfilling family life. But if you have both of those things, you have time for nothing else. You really don't have a lot of friends. You don't have hobbies. You don't really have a lot of sort of extraneous activities. You really are occupied with those two activities, at least for a season. I also think it's very important that there be integrity between our actions and our words. Continuing with the airline motif, this is Glenn Tilton, who served as the CEO of United Airlines. Glenn was one of those people who led his company through bankruptcy. And while he was in the midst of that, they were trying to get the labor unions to make some pretty significant concessions. And Glenn did not pay attention to the way in which you lead with your life. It occurred, there was a particular week when the labor negotiations were pretty intense. As it turned out, all the labor leaders for United in that particular season and all the management team were living in Chicago at the same time. So they would have these late night negotiations that would go until 1 or 2 o'clock in the morning. The management team decided that they would not go back to their homes in the suburbs, but they would just sort of stay downtown in the place where the negotiations were taking place. And in these negotiations, they're trying to get these, you know, labor unions, machinists, flight attendants to make some concessions, to take, you know, a pay cut or to not get the same kind of increase that they were expecting. In small measures, these are, you know, cuts of $2 an hour or $3 an hour, but they could make significant sort of differences in the lives of these families. The problem is that the management team decided that they would just book a series of rooms, suites really, at the Ritz-Carlton in Chicago. So the very moment they're trying to get folks who are making $25,000 a year to take a pay cut, the management team is racking up a bill at the Ritz-Carlton in a city where they all have homes and they all have drivers so they can get to and from there without even driving their cars. They're going to spend $25,000 on their hotel bill that week. You have to pay attention so that your actions and your words really do line up. Because in today's world, you lead with your life. Some of the things that we're trying to think about that I think does have applicability at the K-12 level is, how is it that we create an environment where there's academic freedom, where you really can ask the hard questions? One of the things that I think that the church in general has not done a good job of is grappling with complexity and with incomplete information. We've not done a good job to help our young people to say, we don't always have to have nice, neat little answers. We don't know exactly, and we're willing to change our mind based upon new information. And as a result, young people have got this idea that it all has to be this calcified sort of master set of knowledge that we've all got it figured out. And if anybody introduces something new, the whole thing comes crumbling down. No, the very nature of sort of a gospel-centered approach to learning is that it's dynamic and it's fluid. We're constantly there's a renewal that's occurring in our culture on a daily basis. New insights from pathology allow us to get new information that we wouldn't have expected 15 years ago, and as a result, it helps us to get a better understanding. One of the things we're trying to do at Gordon is to model, how can you have freedom, academic freedom, within a framework of faith? How can we allow students to grapple with problems? One of the key things that we are trying to get to a place where we can manage well is that most college students go through a season of doubt. I don't know if this was true for you, but it is actually true nationwide that there is any one season when committed Christians go through a period of doubt. It happens between the ages of 18 and 29. And most of the time it happens when they go off to college. And so we're trying to figure out, how do we create an environment where it's okay for these fantastic, wonderful Christian young people to have some doubts? And how do we come alongside them and help them to manage those issues? One of the key things that we're trying to address. The other thing that I would say that's important is that we need to be able to create an environment where we provide a sense of spiritual freedom, where we say it is okay for you to ask some of those hard questions, and I'm not going to force us to come up with a Sunday school answer today. Now, one of the problems that we see happening in higher education globally, but it's certainly here in the U.S., is that most of higher learning today is about deconstruction, not reconstruction. So professors become very excited about taking all of your existing understandings and deconstructing them so that nothing makes sense anymore. All your core ideas, you don't understand. And we basically say it's far more important for you to listen to the other person and hear what they have to say than for you to figure out what it is you believe yourself. That's sort of the basic mantra of most of higher education. I actually think that that's an important part of the process, but it is vital that we help young people reconstruct their basic understandings. Most of higher education does not do that. So one of the things that we've got to think about is, how do we create the spiritual freedom where they can ask those questions and have those challenges, but also help them put the pieces back together again. One of the things that we're trying to do is also create an environment where friendships can really flourish. Research shows that if you're only going to make one best friend in your life, it's most likely to happen in college. And so we're trying to create an environment where friendships can flourish. And that is increasingly hard to occur. Why? Because we have become a generation that venerates what David Brooks has described as the organization kid. If you've not read that wonderful essay he wrote for the Atlantic Monthly, I encourage you to read it. Read it this week. The Organization Kit, published by David Brooks, the columnist for the New York Times. It's based on his ethnography of Princeton undergraduates. And in it, he said, basically what has happened is that we've created a whole generation of young people who have become so sophisticated at mastering accomplishments so that they can get into the most prestigious institutions, land the great internship, get the great job when they graduate, and get on their way to professional success. They've become such masters of that that they've actually lost their souls, that they don't even know how to develop friendships, that when they're looking for friendship, the way that they get satisfied is through casual sexual liaisons, hookup culture, that this becomes part of their way of sort of making sense of the world. He said it's a work hard, play hard mantra that gives them license to make stupid decisions, but somehow makes them feel good about making them in the moment. And I think it's also really important for us, particularly those of us who care about Christian education, to help our young people to get a rightly ordered understanding of good, godly ambition. We have become so convinced of the moral rightness of humility that we also forget that there's actually a real call to what John Stott has said, godly, holy ambition, that we need to cultivate that within our young people. It's interesting because you can actually learn so much about your kids even before they're saying words. You can sort of tell their personality. I will say, we were very surprised to have twins. It's a wonderful blessing, a little bit of a shock for us. But it's very interesting because I have two daughters who had the same parents, have had most of exactly the same experiences, go to the same school, they have the same network of friends, they have the same stimuli, and yet they can have very different personalities. One of our daughters, she loves to perform. We did not cultivate this in her. It just comes, it's in her DNA. If I am speaking before a crowd, she is going to be right beside me because she wants to find the microphone. She's drawn to that. And so Rebecca and I have been thinking about how do we channel that desire, which is something that's just part of who she is, in a good, godly way. One of the things that I think that we have not done a good enough job of in the American church is to recognize we have been blessed to be a blessing, and that there is a lot of good for our young people to aspire to excellence and to doing some amazing things. We need to help them to rightly channel ambition in the right ways. One of the things that Karl Barth, 20th century theologian, he likens the notion of a Christian's vocation to a journey to new harbors, a way of moving from one place to another. And one of the key things that I found over the course of the research that I was doing was how important it is for us to be able to help people to conceive of those in ways that are surprising, things that they could not even conceive of. If you told me 5 years ago that I would be living in Boston, Massachusetts, and speaking in San Diego on January 5th, 2015, representing Gordon College, I would have said, you're crazy. This is a picture of Rice, their main academic quad. We were living in Houston. Rebecca and I were having the time of our life. Rebecca's from Dallas. She says that there's a lasso that gets around the neck of a native Texan, and the further they are from the state line, the tighter the pull back to the mothership. And we lived in Princeton, New Jersey for a number of years, lived in the UK, and we moved back to Texas, and I was teaching at Rice. My research was going very well, was loving my teaching, had some wonderful colleagues. We were very involved in our church. Everything was right in the world. We were close to our family. We loved it. It was just a great place. One morning, I got a telephone call from a guy named Price Harding, who was a search consultant, and he said, Michael, I'm calling to talk to you about the presidential search at Gordon College. And I, because of the kind of research I do where I interview a lot of senior leaders, I oftentimes got called for recommendations of people to lead different enterprises. So he began speaking, and really I sort of tuned him out at that moment and began thinking through my mental Rolodex, who am I going to recommend for this job? And so he finishes talking, and I said, okay, Price, here are three folks that I think you ought to talk to. And he said, no, I'm calling to talk to you. And I said, what do you mean to talk to me? And he said, would you consider this particular opportunity? And I said, oh, come on, give me a break. I was 37 at the time. untenured faculty member at Rice. I mean, I had not held any leadership position, not done anything like that. I said, you know, at some point in time, I'd love to do something in academic leadership, but it's probably 10 to 15 years down the road. It is not something I see myself doing anytime in the future. He said, well, would you be willing to pray about it? Well, what am I supposed to say? Yes, of course. So I prayed about it. I said we were pretty reluctant prayers, not really taking it all that seriously. And then about a month later, I got another phone call. Same office. It was my mom. And she called to tell me that my 32-year-old cousin, Trent, had been killed in a car accident that morning. I loved Trent. I'm an only child. He was my cousin, but he was really like my little brother. I had performed the wedding ceremony for he and his wife. He left behind her and three young kids. It was devastating. The family asked me to perform the funeral, and so I delivered the eulogy at Trent's funeral. Then we packed up the kids and started driving back to Houston on a Sunday afternoon. As we were going down the highway, I began to think about Trent and his life. He died on November 2nd of 2010. It was about 7 weeks away from Christmas. I began to wonder, what was he going to get his kids for Christmas that year? Wonder what he thought his next big promotion at work was going to be. Wonder what he thought he might be doing 10 to 15 years from now. And in that moment, I remembered that conversation from a month earlier, where that search consultant asked me about Gordon. It dawned on me, you know, we are not promised tomorrow. And I realized that a part of my reservation about Gordon was really pride. Truth be told, I was at a top 20 research university. Most of the people in my environment, if I mentioned the name Rice, it conjured up notions of prestige, and I looked good because I was a faculty member there. And not everybody in my social environment knew Gordon College or knew it. It's a different kind of place. And I realized part of my reservation was I just wasn't sure if that's really where I wanted to be. Part of the notion of Christian vocation is that we really have been blessed to be a blessing, and that at different times in our life, God can make a calling to doing something. One of the reasons why I wanted to come speak tonight is because I think we're about something much bigger than ourselves. I spent 10 years of my life interviewing some of the people who make really big decisions that affect all of our lives. They run some of the largest enterprises of our culture. And I am convinced that we need more committed Christ followers in those kinds of positions of responsibility. And part of that is a willingness to be open to whatever God is leading them to do. And it is not always about prestige or ranking. It is not always about performance or accomplishment. Being faithful really is being successful. I think that that's one of the key messages we need to communicate. And so, it's my hope that we can work in partnership in trying to help create a generation of committed Christ followers who cultivate a moral imagination and a commitment to serve not only their interests, but also the interests of others, a commitment to serving the common good. Thank you very much.